Redesigning a magazine or newspaper is always a delicate matter, but when it's a publication read by as many people as the New York Times magazine or French weekly L'Express, the pressure is all the greater. We spoke to their designers and redesigners about the processes they use and the secrets to their high-pressure craft. That's ahead today on The Stack. On today's programme, we hear some expert insights on redesigning a magazine. We speak with the man responsible for the new look of French weekly magazine L'Express. We also speak to Gail Bischler, the design director of the New York Times magazine.
We have a lot of conversations. The editor is really involved in the process of making these covers. What I usually try and do is get him to boil down each of the cover stories to like one line.
All that coming up on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. For this week's programme, I'm delighted to welcome back to our studios the graphic designer Mark Porter, the man who oversaw the reformatting of The Guardian newspaper from broadsheet to Berliner, and who now has redesigned one of the leading French weeklies, L'Express. Mark, it's an absolute pleasure, a delight no less, to have you here on The Stack. Obviously, one of our preoccupations is challenging the idea that, you know, print is dead, which people tediously continue to suggest. Tell me a bit about your view on this, because we know there are challenges facing all sorts of different print media companies. Do you think there's ever a problem that brilliant design can't address?
I don't think design can solve all problems. You know, the reason people read magazines and newspapers is because of great content, great stories well told. Design has a role to play in that. Also, I think people can form very intimate relationships with magazines and newspapers, and design can contribute a lot to that. But design in itself can't solve your problem. You know, people don't buy magazines and newspapers for design. I mean, some strange people like me do, but most normal, well-adjusted
people. There are a few listeners as well to our show, believe me.
Normal, well-adjusted people don't buy things because of how they look. They buy them because of the editing, the writing, the photography, and design, of course, plays a role, but it's not the whole story.
Mark, it's obviously at that point it intrigues me. If we look at a recent project, say the redesign of L'Express, which has been, you know, very, very well received. Tell me a bit about exactly that point then. What's the process like in your mind, at least, when you are looking at a big redesign of a well-known, you know, a well-known title, very celebrated, very popular with many? Do you have to sort of take this twin approach and talk and look at all of the different requirements of the editorial team, specific as they are in each case? Or do you try and bring, I don't know, some air of sort of design detachment to that process? Is it possible to retain that?
Well, I think it's fair to say that all successfully designed publications, it's about the relationship between editing and art direction and design. So you can never completely separate those things. You can't be existing in different worlds. You have to collaborate and feed off each other. And the best magazines do that. You know, the editors stimulate the art directors and the photo editors, and the art team stimulates the editors. So that's how it needs to be. But when you're doing redesigns and relaunches, you're very often called in because a publication is not performing as well as it could or has slightly lost its way. And that was definitely the case with L'Express. So we're often in the position of being the people who have to sort of dig down into the history of the magazine and rediscover its kind of spirit and what made it special and unique in the first place, and try and, you know, reinvent that and bring it back. And we're obviously doing that for the benefit of the audience. We're trying to sell more magazines. But we're often doing it for the benefit of the journalists too, trying to kind of remind them what made their magazine special in the first place. So coming in from the outside, it's often easier to do that than to see from the inside. And that's very much what we did in this case.
And I think this choice of language is interesting, because I think in a press release actually I was reading from Mark Porter Associates, they talked with the L'Express project about reinterpreting, I think was the word, elements from the magazines. Because, you know, these magazines often have such a rich history. And you use the word there, I think, reimagining or something like that. Yeah. Is that a real challenge for designers? Because obviously, I guess, sometimes having a blank slate, it's too massive an opportunity. In a way, having a sort of these different frames of reference, that can be helpful? Or I don't know, how do you view that?
It
challenge?
Is helpful. I mean, because of the process that we often go through of working with existing publications or existing brands and trying to kind of give them their energy back in a way, we do have an obvious path to follow in terms of researching the history and the, you know, the culture of the magazine. And in this case, you know, we found amazing things about what L'Express was in the 1960s when it was in its first golden age. You know, there was so much going on then in the world, you know, the Vietnam War, the riots in Paris in 1968 and stuff. And this was a magazine that had incredible reach and influence discussing those issues. Mm. It had astounding people writing for it. Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, François Sagan, all these amazing writers.
It's not a bad roster.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's great to have that sort of track to go down. Obviously, if you're creating a brand new publication, and we've sometimes been asked to do that too, then it's liberating in a way because you don't have that kind of history, but then you have to invent it for yourself. Mm. And I guess it's kind of what you guys did with Monocle. That was a brand new launch. But it still is very important that you have a clear personality and a clear view of the world and a clear attitude, and you understand what you stand for and what you believe. And in a way, it's harder to kind of make that up from scratch than it is to build it up over a period of years.
And on the point you made previously about being called in often because things aren't quite going the way that an editorial team want or a management team or whoever it might be, again, is that good for a designer? Or in a way, would you like the challenge? Do you sometimes get the challenge of going into a publication that's maybe absolutely at the top of its game? Or I guess people tend to follow that idea, the idiom that if it ain't broke, they don't fix it. But would you wish maybe that successful publications who arrive in the crest of the wave might do that more?
Occasionally, and actually, you know, I always say to clients that the best time to redesign and relaunch and reinvigorate yourself is when you're doing well. You know, you don't really want to be reacting to circumstances.
Yeah. What do they tend to say when you say that?
Well, maybe speak to us in 6 months. Or... Well, some of them, you know, we have a couple of clients that we work with who are very successful and just want to build on that success. And it's great when you get to do that. Mm. But inevitably, you know, you're often more of a problem solver trying to work out why something isn't performing as well as it could and trying to improve that.
Now, Mark, tell me a little bit about, I guess, the anatomy of a project, if you like. Obviously, they're very different depending on the specific challenges. But we mentioned L'Express. We've got a few of those here, which I'm leafing through. Newspapers as well, you're very well known for, be it the Guardian to Berliner switch here in the UK, or I know you've recently completed a project with, I think it's Denmark's oldest. So many to choose from. Are there things which are always follow a similar pattern in terms of how you and your colleagues work? Or is it necessarily the case that every project requires, you know, its own beginning, middle and end?
The briefs vary, and we always, you know, try to respond to the needs and the requirements of the client. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of methodology that we tend to follow because we often do get involved in things which have a history. So it usually starts with going through the archive, just trying to kind of understand the cultural history of an organization, which we did with L'Express, which started in the 1950s. And we discovered some pure gold in the 60s and 70s, really exciting kind of design elements, which we were able to feed into the new design. With something like Berlingske, it goes back a long way. Berlingske is one of the oldest newspapers in Europe, founded in 1749. So, you know, the historical
journey is really deep.
And
I guess you can't necessarily look at the whole breadth of that sort of history, but did you find, I mean, was it possible to delve back into, I don't know, the 18th century? Are there
it
useful
was. I mean, they
tenets
have,
from there
you know,
as well?
They have issues going all the way back to the very first one, which is a kind of smaller than A4 format. And, you know, there's not much you can take out of a piece of newspaper design from the 18th century and bring into the 21st century. But, for example, with Berlingske, from the very beginning, it had a heraldic crest, which evolved over the years. And that became a really nice little side project on its own, as well as designing the newspaper. And we often find that this happens to us. You come in to do a piece of publication design, but what you're really doing is a kind of brand identity project where you're creating a kind of visual voice for the organization. And in this case, the crest became a really important part of that, going back over the history of how it evolved and trying to create a modern version of it, which still respected the history and the tradition. And in the case of Berlingske, it has some strong rivals in Copenhagen. Politiken is the main one, the main rival daily newspaper there. But they don't have that history. And that is one of the things that we really wanted to celebrate, because it's something that makes them unique that their competitors can't say. Mm-hmm. So to really pay some attention to something like that heraldic crest, it becomes a kind of emblem of their history and one of their unique qualities.
If we look at something like that project or L'Express, presumably it's often part of the brief to address this idea of the schism in media between print and digital.
Yeah.
And there's also an understandable drive to make sure that the future consumers of media, whether we call them readers or not, come to this publication. So, you know, a younger demographic, for example. That's obviously what the, you know, I imagine the people who hand the briefs over to you say. Does that ever sound alarm bells to you? Or from what you say, you're a pragmatist about this. That is important. We need to win the next generation of readers on side. Are you comfortable with that idea, particularly if the challenge is how do we make sure that either instead of or alongside their reading on a tablet, for example, they're still picking up print?
It's inevitable, I think, that nowadays the discussion always involves the relationship between print and digital. It's very hard to be a print-only magazine these days without having an existence also on the web and in social media. It doesn't mean that you can't make a strong printed magazine, and we should be trying to make printed magazines that people still really want to read. But, you know, it's not a walled garden now. You have to exist on a lot of different platforms. And there's a kind of strange double life now that magazines live. I think even if the printed magazine is the kind of heart and soul of what you do, the way that you're promoting it and what you're doing on social media and on the web is not disconnected, but it can be complementary. You know, you have to think in a different way. So doing a magazine cover 20 years ago, you really just had to make a cover that looked great on the newsstand. But if you're doing a magazine cover nowadays, you're also thinking this has to be an event on social media on a particular type of magazine. So if you look at, you know, every time Vanity Fair does a new cover, they're announcing it on social media, and often that's really taking off and becoming a meme and sort of having a whole other life there that's not quite disconnected from the print magazine. Hopefully it drives people back to the print magazine. So, for example, when we do a project like Lexpress, we're not just trying to think, you know, how does the cover work on the magazine, particularly things like the logo. You're having to think, how does the logo work on the magazine? How will it work as a web header on big screens and small screens? How will it work as a, you know, as an icon on social media? How will it animate in motion graphics? So even if you're really concentrating on a print project, you have to be aware of what the other kind of channels are that the identity is going to flow into, and create things which can adapt and function in those environments.
And kind of a bit of a tangent to that, but this idea that, you know, in the digital space, and it's amazing to think really this is only an argument or a discussion that people have been having for what, a couple of decades really at the most. This idea that it's a great democratizing space, and actually everyone can be a great magazine designer because, you know, the resources are there. There's lots of open source things that are available. For a long time, I guess the first sort of 10 years, if you like, of the internet age, whatever you want to call it, people said, look, this is all positive. Does part of you as a veteran, as a great designer, think, well, actually, just being available to everyone isn't great? It's not good that everyone's a designer. It's good to have people who've built up their craft over, you know, a generation or more. How do you feel about that idea?
I have quite strong feelings about it. I used to work with a guy when I was doing a magazine called Colours in Italy. I worked with a guy called Tibor Kalman, who's sadly passed away, who was the editor of that magazine. And he was a great provocateur. And he used to say things like, why do designers think that they know more about design than ordinary people? And of course, Tibor actually believed that designers did know more, but he would say things like that to get you thinking. And I think what he really meant by that was that there's nothing wrong with expertise. You know, I believe in experts. It's good to have expert doctors and accountants and everything else. And I think there's such a thing as an expert designer. You know, you do learn your craft, and really you ought to be better at it than somebody who hasn't had the same experience as you. But what you have to do is not approach it in an elitist frame of mind. And you have to do things with respect for the audience and affection for the audience. And that's what we always try to do. We don't try to design for ourselves or for other designers, and we're not kind of riffing on our own virtuosity. We're trying to create things that people love to read or look at or engage with, you know, in a digital environment. And that kind of awareness of the audience and sensitivity to the audience is absolutely at the heart of it. And I think that's the kind of thing that actually you do build up over a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find it interesting that it's quite hard to be a successful architect below the age of 40. You know, most great architects are in their 50s and 60s, and that's because they've got experience of people. You know, they've got life experience, and that really feeds into how people engage with the space and move around the building. And I think actually you can make the same argument for publication design. You know, you have to have some experience of people and how people behave and what they like in order to create magazines that people love to read.
And I guess another thing, if we look at that example of architects, is that they've had plenty of opportunities to work on projects that maybe haven't gone very well. In that space as well, it's amazing to talk to a lot of graphic designers or creative directors, and they say you learn more when things go badly than you do when they go well. Is that been your experience? of course, you don't have to name names on specific projects, but feel free if you want. I mean, are there some, do you look back and think, I don't know, even maybe relatively recently, where there are still, I guess you could still almost describe them as formative experiences, where things don't work out?
I'm happy to say that they're quite rare for
That's
us.
That's good.
I think I've learned most from the ones that did work out, like The Guardian, you know, which was a great project that I learned a lot from working with brilliant editors on. Mm. And we had a decent amount of time to do that and a decent budget and a great editorial product to work with. You know, we do have the odd project that doesn't work very successfully. And I think I've learned a bit from that about dealing with different cultures. You know, I can think of two projects, which I won't name, which were not enormous successes, one that we did in France and one that we did in Italy. And I think they really came down to poor communication in the end, either the client not really communicating to us what they wanted or not communicating to us if they felt that we were sort of slightly off track. And we do a lot of work in, you know, most of our work is international. We do a lot of work in Scandinavia, Northern Europe, in the Netherlands and stuff. And there I always feel that communication is very, very easy. But there's something about Northern Europeans working in Southern Europe where things start to get a little bit harder.
Oh, it's the old North-South divide that I've heard about before. A slightly different one, perhaps.
I think, you know, there's a people behave differently there, and sometimes they don't always tell you, you know, exactly what they're thinking in a very direct way. You have to try and work it out. So, you know, we gain experience from those situations of how to deal with people who speak different languages and exist in different cultures and make our projects more successful.
Now, Mark, you mentioned the Guardian redesign there. Obviously, if you have a project like that that's so successful that actually people begin to almost use as a shorthand for how to do a redesign well, with all different challenges, yeah, Berliner formats and so on, do you find it easy not to then tread a similar path again? How do you ensure that you don't allow yourself to say, oh, I recognise these constraints, yeah, and I recognise how to think creatively out of this? Is that something you constantly keep yourself on your toes, or is it quite easy actually?
Well, of course, any creative person doesn't want to repeat themselves, so you try and guard against that. I do think it's the flip side of what we were talking about before in terms of having a lot of experience. You know, if you do this job for many years, it turns out that you've encountered a lot of the problems before, and you can see quick solutions to them. And what you have to try and do is stop yourself doing the obvious solution and force yourself to find a different solution to things. And that's a constant challenge. But, you know, we keep on trying not to repeat ourselves and to find new ways of doing things.
Now, Mark, I often ask guests on the Stack about what jumps out at them on newsstand. You know, yeah. Is it a great face? Is it a great portrait? Is it a piece of, you know, a font? You're not quite sure what it is. And as a sort of parallel to that, I wanted to ask you this question. Can you divorce or detach your critical eye from your consumer's eye? So do you look at newsstand titles and think, I'd love to have a go at that? Can you look at things and accept them all for what they are, with their failings as well as their appeals?
Well, it's quite hard for me to switch off my designer's eye. So, you know, to be honest, when I go to a kiosk and I look at a range of magazines, I am making judgments about how well designed I think they are, how impactful I think they are. And, you know, you can't really switch off your professionalism in that way. When I'm reading things, I try to approach things as a reader and not engage with magazines just because of how they look or how they're structured or whatever. So, you know, my favorite magazine is The New Yorker. And you could say that it's brilliantly designed because it's almost undesigned, you know, but I wouldn't cite it as a fantastic example of publication design, but I would cite it as an amazing reading experience. And that's why I read that magazine more than any other, because it's brilliantly written and edited. And the form is appropriate to the content, even if it's not something that, you know, gives a lot of satisfaction to me as a designer.
Okay, and so I can't push you to tell me the one big project you'd love to have a crack at, or do you think there is a... Maybe it's a defunct title, so you can be very diplomatic.
We still do a lot of print, we do a lot of digital, but we've also started to do a bit of broadcast design. We did a big project for RTL in the Netherlands, and what I wouldn't mind getting my hands on is BBC News, because I think the graphic standards there are not what they should be. That would be a really nice one to get stuck into.
Are you listening? Over at MBH, do get in touch. So, Mark, let me just ask you finally maybe about some trends as we go forwards. Obviously, I know your kind of book of projects is always packed and busy, and there's some intriguing things which sadly we can't get into that we'll be learning more about, I'm sure, in the months ahead. What are the key trends? We've got things like Modern Magazine Conference happening in London. We often talk about the independent magazine sector, and there's a lot of bold graphic design we see there. For the big titles, a lot of things like L'Espresso, you know, really big audiences, a lot of the work that you do, how confident are you? I mean, I began by talking about this death of print thing.
Yeah.
Do you think the challenges are shifting, or is it these same things, reconciling the challenges of digital? What's going to mark out, I don't know, if we spoke in 6 months from now?
Well, digital is not going away. And, you know, I think it's very important, no matter how much we believe in print and love print, not to see digital as the enemy. Mm. You know, you can have an amazing printed magazine as the heart of your ecosystem, but you have to be doing a lot of other stuff too, as Monocle does. You know, you've got the web and the radio and the products and the shops and the cafes. And I think that's the future, taking what's great about magazine brands and trying to do a lot of different services and activities with them that celebrate the kind of identity and personality of the product. But in the end, you know, if we want people to read print, we just have to be creating fantastic magazines full of amazing stories that are beautifully art directed. And if the content is interesting enough and relevant enough to the audience, they will come and read them.
If you make it, they will come. Is that the expression? Yeah. I think it is. Mark Porter, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on The Stack. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Now, last week, as you would have heard if you listened last time out, London hosted the Modern Magazine Conference, organised by Stack regular and friend and founder of Mag Culture, Jeremy Leslie. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco was there and caught up with one of the speakers, Gail Bischler, the design director of the renowned New York Times magazine. Gail spoke about the relaunch of the mag last year and the pressures of delivering a groundbreaking cover every single week.
Gay, of course. I mean, the New York Times Magazine is one of the most respected, you know, newspaper magazines. But I would like to know more about the design changes that happened last year. I mean, it was quite beautiful, in my opinion. But I wonder if you can tell us, because you know, there's some perils when you redesign a magazine as well. You always wonder if it's going to work out. But I think in your case, it did.
Thank you. We got a new editor in 2015, and he had a different vision for the magazine. And one of the things that we wanted to do was make the magazine a bit more multi-platform and also adjust to the kind of adjusting landscape in publishing. So we wanted to bring the magazine back more in line with the original goals of it, which were to really showcase visual journalism and also literary long-form writing. So the design was aimed at making the magazine like a great place for photography and really having kind of longer pieces and shorter essays, very much having a literary feeling. And then we also took a look at the brand. We redesigned the logo, and we came up with other brand assets that would be used online that were very cohesive. And as far as the fonts, we were also looking to make something that was very distinctive, very unique to us, that we'd be able to use online so that when people would come to our content, which they often do through Facebook or, you know, another social platform, that they would be able to look at our features online and just know that it came from the Times. So we were looking to really strengthen the overall brand.
And I want to know about the process of making a covers. I mean, you have amazing covers every week. I mean, how often in advance are they planned? I mean, do you have any sort of strategies or, you know, every cover you try to do something different? I mean, do they have you complete freedom to do that, for example?
Most of our covers are done in terms of, like, the conceptual covers. They're done anywhere from between 2 weeks and 2 days. And, of course, there are other covers that, for example, things that have documentary photography, which we're kind of much further out on. We do aim to have a lot of variety with the magazine, so we're always thinking about what we've done in the past little while, and then the magazine has a really long history where we've done just about everything, so we're always thinking about what we're making in terms of things that have been made in the past. And in terms of how we approach them, for the conceptual covers, for the most part, my approach to them is really language-based. So I tend to read the stories pretty closely. I read them through a couple times. And we have a lot of conversations. The editor is really involved in the process of making these covers. What I usually try and do is get him to boil down each of the cover stories to, like, one line. And actually, even better, sometimes I ask him to give us working language, because that not only kind of conveys the main point of a story, but it also gives you a sense of the attitude that they're looking for. So then I go and try and, you know, come up with, think really flexibly and come up with a lot of different kinds of ideas, different ways to approach both that line and then also other themes in the story, because I found that our editor is actually very open to a different visual approach than the one that he had in mind. And so often if we come up with something that he really likes, he will write a different line to make that cover work. So it's a very integrated process.
And it's interesting as well, of course, you're designing not for a small publication, but simply for one of the biggest newspapers in America. So you're speaking to such a vast audience as well. But I feel that the design, it can be quite risky at times, but that's quite a good thing as well. You know, you don't play it safe just because, you know, you're a big newspaper with big sales and you have a guaranteed almost audience in a way.
Yeah, we definitely try and take risks. That's part of what we do. Magazines are different from newspapers. They're often meant to provoke or entertain. And you want, you know, buzz surrounding the thing that you're making. And the covers in particular really are almost pieces of their own at this point because of the way they make the rounds through social media. And so you want to make something that is impactful. And I feel if you are too safe with things, you really don't ever make anything interesting. So we've taken some chances. But we also do have a pretty good process of vetting things. There's a lot of restrictions in terms of what we make. We have a lot of visual freedom, but in terms of how we portray things, how accurate we are to the story, just a feeling of, you know, things not being biased or kind of making something that could be interpreted in a way that's offensive. We have a lot of like checks and balances and a lot of discussions about the covers that we make, which, you know, I find to be really helpful. Even in the end, if we decide to publish something that is risky and maybe could be interpreted in a way that we wouldn't want, we at least feel like we have done due diligence and talked about it and understand what we're making and why. So it's a very thoughtful process.
And finally, I was wondering, what do you think about, you know, other supplements of newspapers around the world? I know you were just talking here with Christoph from Zeit magazine as well. And do you think there's some sort of resurgence about those magazines from newspapers? You know, at least certainly here in Europe, you saw, you know, Le Monde, of Zeit, Die Zeit, and of course, the New York Times as well.
Yeah, I do think that is happening. And I think it's been interesting in our industry to watch, you know, a lot of newspapers struggling. But I think the ones that remain are strong and are reinvesting in print as a medium and really adjusting and changing to the idea of making a print product that is something that has a bit more of a lifespan and making it a memorable, covetable object. And I think that's affecting a lot of the way that newspaper magazines are being made, and for the better, I think.
Gail Bishler sharing some insights with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco here in London last week. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks, as always, to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course to our editor, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome. Drop us a note. Fernando's at fp@monocle.com, and don't forget to join us next Saturday at the very same time. If you're going to miss us before then, delve into the archive or listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Until next time, it's goodbye.